Is Russia about to attack NATO? Could such attacks be going on already? Canada and America on the brink of trade war with Lake Ontario caught in the crossfire, and some of the last vestiges of the Syrian civil war have come to an end. We'll look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Two high-profile visits to Moscow this week have caused a lot of alarm all around the world. The CIA director John Ratcliffe arrived on a C-17 military transport plane and stayed in Moscow for about 8 hours. And Archbishop Paul Gallagher, a senior figure for the Vatican foreign policy, also came to Russia. He met with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Both these men were in Moscow in November 2021, and 3 months later, Russia started its full invasion of Ukraine. Neither of these men have been back until now. It's got a lot of people talking. Why did they feel the need to go and visit Vladimir Putin? A lot of the speculation is that there's some kind of intelligence that an attack from Vladimir Putin on a NATO country is imminent, or some dramatic escalation of the war in Ukraine is imminent, and that these people were heading there to try and talk Putin down from catastrophe, really. So the potential of major escalation with the war between Russia and Ukraine. But that's not the only way things could escalate. It's not just about a 3 months off, say, Russian plan to do something dramatic. The attacks on NATO may be happening already. So to bring that into the discussion, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. Some of these attacks, smaller scale attacks, have already been happening for months. The Telegraph compiled a report about these on Sunday. And their report shows that Russia has carried out several attacks on weapons manufacturing facilities in various European nations. But the Russians, at least at this point, are doing it in a clandestine, shadowy kind of way. Instead of sending Russian agents to carry out these attacks themselves, they're using messaging apps to recruit members of right-wing extremist groups in European nations. Many of these kinds of groups already espouse some pro-Russia, pro-Putin kinds of sentiments. So it's easy enough for the Russians to recruit these Europeans over. And the Russians, of course, sweeten the deal by throwing plenty of cryptocurrency at them as well. And it's interesting because the Russians instruct these European individuals who they recruit not to carry out the attacks themselves, but to function only as intermediaries. So the European intermediaries then pass some of the Russian cryptocurrency to other local criminals who they know as payment for carrying out acts of arson and other kinds of sabotage on these weapons facilities. So this keeps kind of a degree of separation between the Russians who are masterminding the whole thing and the actual perpetrators. And in most cases, the actual perpetrators don't even know that it's Russia that's ultimately behind these operations. The latest of these kinds of attacks took place in Estonia, the nation of Estonia, on August 15th. That's when arsonists set fire to a facility operated by Milrom Robotics. That's one of Ukraine's biggest suppliers of unmanned ground vehicles. And during the week before that attack, there were explosions in both Bulgaria and Italy. Both of those struck major weapons facilities in those nations, and both of those facilities were producing ammunition for Ukraine, and they suffered major explosions, August 10th for the Bulgarian firm and August 13th for the Italian one. And then if we go back to March, there was a similar situation at a defense factory in Czechia. This was a factory that produces drones and thermal imaging equipment for Ukraine, and before that, there were saboteurs in Lithuania trying to set fire to a facility there that makes radio frequency scanners for Ukraine's military. So this is quite a robust campaign that we're seeing from the Russians. And it's all done, as I said, in a way that gives Russia a measure of plausible deniability. But it is advancing Russia's goals because it not only weakens these companies that are helping Ukraine to defend itself. But it also makes some European governments kind of think twice about continuing their support for Ukraine. And then on top of all that, it also shows Russia just how far it can push certain European nations. Part of this Telegraph report says, "With each attack that goes unpunished, the Russians are gathering their own useful intelligence on just how far they can push NATO's boundaries." End quote. So the Russians are gathering a lot of valuable intel, and every time an attack is met by the Europeans with little more than a little bit of, you know, finger wagging, the Russians learn that they can go even further next time, or that they can increase the frequency of these kinds of attacks, which is what's been happening in recent weeks. So the Russians are pushing harder and harder, and this is all extremely alarming to the Europeans. You know, these nations are having their defense companies set on fire and being sabotaged in other ways. And this means that the Europeans today are very much awake to the Russian threat. And in response, they're rapidly militarizing. And this is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been warning about for years now, just calling attention to the way Russia's aggression is really galvanizing the European nations and making them more quickly militarize and unite. And his warnings are all founded on biblical prophecy. He explains it all in that context. So if anyone would like to understand what's underway in Russia and in Europe in that context and what it's all leading to, I would encourage you to read Mr. Fleury's article. It's called "Russia's War on Ukraine is Reshaping Europe."
So how this, you said this is based on a report from the Telegraph. How confident can we be that this is correct, that Russia is in fact sponsoring attacks on European soil? And then is this something that European governments are likely to kind of know and believe is correct? Does the German government, for example, or the French government believe that this is happening?
Well, the various nations that have suffered these kinds of acts of sabotage, they have detained several suspects in them. And at this point, they've not published official findings, but especially in Eastern Europe, you'll find authorities announcing that they are specifically investigating ties between the saboteurs and the Russian government. So at this point, it's only investigations that are being carried out. And in Eastern Europe, the authorities acknowledge the possibility and the likelihood of Russian ties. But it's interesting that you would mention some of those other governments further west, because in Italy and Germany, for example, they're trying to downplay Russian connections. At this point, it seems like authorities are well aware that Russia is probably behind it, but they don't want to publicly, overtly kind of point the finger at the Russians. And I think that's due to some, well, a whole range of factors. But in many cases, the Western Europeans are more concerned about escalation than the Eastern Europeans, who are saying, we've already escalated. We're past fears of escalation. So there's some division there between Eastern Europe and Western Europe, which the Russians are very keen to exploit. They love those kinds of divisions in Europe and in NATO, because they can just drive a wedge between the more fearful, you know, Eastern European nations and the more conscientious, you could say, more trepidatious Western European nations.
So is this something that could be treated as an act of war if some of those Western nations in particular, that are the ones, you know, Germany, France, that have the military resources, if they so wanted to, and thereby, you know, by not pointing the finger at Russia, they can avoid that kind of embarrassment? Or is it something that would typically fall below, say, a threshold of an act of war, maybe a sending home the ambassador?
It seems that the Russians are trying to keep everything below the threshold of what would trigger an official, a NATO action or something along those lines. But it sort of depends on the paper trail. I think that if those perpetrators who have actually carried out these attacks, if it's proven that they were following Russian orders from the Russian government, it's hard to see how the Europeans, even those in the Western European nations who kind of just want this to go away, it's hard to see how they would be able to ignore it. But I think at this point, we just have to wait and see.
And this point about Europe's prophesied response to Russia and what Mr. Flurry said for years, Mr. Armstrong even before then, pretty much all the rest of the main stories that I have from Europe this week all are about Europe responding to Russian aggression and European fear. And okay, there's a, we don't necessarily want to rock the boat with Russia right now, but at the same time, they're rapidly preparing for when that day will come, when they will have to, or when they will have even the opportunity to respond to Russia. So Bild this week had a story about Volkswagen with a secret rescue plan to try and keep its factory open by switching from civilian vehicles to military trucks. I mean, this ties into a couple of the big stories in Germany where you've had that industrial decline. The, you know, VW, they're looking at having to cut 50,000 jobs, close several factories. But here, they could keep one open by building more arms. And the German government wants more arms. You've got Poland welcoming in soldiers from Germany to help fortify their borders with Russia, with the enclave of Kaliningrad and with Belarus, after Poland has repeatedly said, we don't want any German soldiers on our soil, where one said it would take at least seven generations. Another seven, 2014, he said it's going to be seven generations before German soldiers on Polish soil would be acceptable. I guess seven generations on from World War II. Poland has blocked German Patriot missile batteries being deployed in Poland, but now they're welcoming in German engineers to come and build their border, build up their border. This is exactly what Mr. Flurry was talking about in practice. Fear of Europe driving, or fear of Russia driving Poland to Germany, changing their mind, changing their stance. Even Britain is talking about something similar. There's a lot of headlines in Britain this week about, is Putin going to respond? The new British Prime Minister, Andy Burnham, was over in Ukraine, giving Ukraine the details of our Storm Shadow missiles so they can make their own. There's a lot of intelligence sharing, and there's threats from Russia saying, well, we're going to take vengeance. And in this context, we had a story in The Telegraph this week that Germany might come along and offer Britain financial support for its Trident nuclear defense program. This is the ultimate defense against Russia, our main nuclear adversary, but it's built around four aging nuclear submarines. It desperately needs funding that we don't have. And so The Telegraph quoted one a well-placed source saying that Germany wanted to better integrate itself into the existing British and French nuclear deterrents and didn't want to build its own nuclear weapon, but wanted to, you know, put money into Britain and France's program to be covered that way. So we've got Britain, it's financial pressures, but fear of Russia, the need to continue having a nuclear program, that is absolutely part of the pressures that is pushing Britain towards making a deal with Germany. So this point that Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Flurry really hammered as being a key prophetic point, a key driver of the rise of this prophesied Holy Roman Empire. I mean, it really is driving so many of the different news events this week. So that is critical to watch, and it's a critical driver of European militarization. Well, perhaps the most eye-catching, the most iconic, the most tragic news story of this week comes from Nepal, where there's just been dramatic footage from the floods and the flooding that's hit that country. That's also in your region, Jeremiah. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, these were just absolutely devastating flash floods that hit Nepal on Wednesday. It all started when the lower tongue of a glacier broke free way up in the Himalayan mountains, and this glacier chunk dropped thousands of feet and slammed into a river, and it dammed the river up, so a great deal of water just built up behind it, but the pressure kept building and building and eventually broke through, and it sent millions of tons of water, mud, and stone just crashing into the unsuspecting people and their settlements below. And the footage of this will just chill you to the marrow. The amount of force and power on display and the merciless devastation of this wall of water, the video footage of it, it really is just beyond horrifying. The death toll from this is already up to 553 as of this morning, but there are hundreds of people still missing. And in those videos, it's hard to see how many of the people who were swept away would have had much chance at all of surviving it. So it looks like the death toll will be rising quite a lot. And Trumpet managing editor Joel Hilliker wrote all about this in yesterday's morning brief. He takes a really high altitude look at why God allows these kinds of disasters to happen. We have a whole booklet on this topic, which Mr. Hilliker mentions in his brief. So if anyone would like to understand why God allowed this devastation in Nepal and other weather disasters of this kind, I think that that morning brief from yesterday would be illuminating and very helpful. And we can leave a link to that in our show notes for anyone who would like to check that out.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Well, things are heating up between the US and Canada, two of usually the closest countries on Earth in terms of friendship. Now they're falling out quite badly, both over trade wars and while it's somehow escalated even to include Lake Ontario. To get the latest on this, we'll go to our Anglo-America correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, trade tensions between the United States and Canada have been growing for some years now, primarily involving auto parts that are manufactured in Canada, sent to the United States. The Trump administration had sent a team to negotiate some new trade deals with Canada. It looked like for a while that those negotiations might go well. Now they've definitely took a sharp downturn at this week, with at the very beginning of this week, the Trump administration coming out and basically announcing a 50% tariff on about $20 million worth of Canadian goods. And then the Canadian side not backing down at the tariff threat, basically came right back and did their own dollar-for-dollar tariffs on about $20 million worth of American goods. In terms of exactly why the breakdown in the trade negotiations happened, it looks like the Canadian side is saying that it was more of a disagreement between the two trade envoys, with the one envoy promising certain concessions that they later reneged on. That made the whole thing fall apart. The American excuse is that it was specifically a clause over truck parts for trucks and the bigger auto administration dispute that they weren't able to come to a compromise over. So right now, it definitely looks like it's escalating. Like I said, America put tariffs on $20 million worth of Canadian goods. Canada responded with $20 million on American goods. And then to add insult to injury, President Trump tried to do a diplomatic slight by changing the name. He actually signed an executive order this week, so this isn't something he's threatening to do. This is something he's already done. Changing the name of Lake Ontario to Lake America.
So on that, you mentioned it's something he's actually done. Given that Lake Ontario has been Lake Ontario before the United States of America were the United States of America, does he have, in whose eyes is that done, I guess? Who is taking him as the authority or an executive order as the authority? Is it just the U.S. Geographic Survey? Are we going to have Google Maps do where you look on Lake Ontario and it's called Lake America if you're within the United States, but Lake Ontario if you're outside? Do you have a sense of how widespread the change is?
Yes, I do, actually, because Google will do what Google wants to do, and Apple will do what Apple wants to do, and the National Geographic Society will do what the National Geographic Society will do. The United States is not a dictatorship. President Trump doesn't actually have the authority to force people to call certain places by certain names. But he is the chief executive of the American executive branch of government, and therefore does have, and his executive orders are orders to the executive branch of the U.S. government. As the chief executive, he tells the executive branch how to enforce laws. So legally, this executive order would only apply to the executive branch of the U.S. government. It wouldn't even necessarily apply to Congress and the Supreme Court because they're separate branches of government, though they may decide to go along with it anyway. So primarily, this is going to be State Department correspondence. So the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Secretary of State, all executive branch employees under President Trump's authority. So same thing as with the Gulf of America. Everyone in the State Department, everyone in the CIA, everyone in the FBI, everyone in all the executive agencies now calls it by the official term the chief executive set. Now, whether Americans who don't work for the federal government change the name is completely up to them. It's a naming convention for the executive branch. Like you pointed out, this is actually an interesting one. I don't know if President Trump knows this or not, but it's a bit of historical trivia, is that actually the province of Ontario was named for the lake, not the other way around.
So Ontario should change it. America should start referring to Ontario as America. That could get confusing.
Yes. Yeah, the lake is actually an Iroquois Indian word for beautiful lake, and it's been called that since before Europeans came to North America.
But it's also not the first time its name has been changed. Did you know this? I didn't. I was looking this up ahead of the show. The European that discovered it, I'm going to say the guy that discovered it because nobody was writing about it so before then, so I guess it wasn't really discovered. But he named it Lake St. Louis. So that was its original name in that sense, and then it was gradually adopted instead as people called it. You know, the name didn't catch on, and instead Lake Ontario did. I'm kind of glad it didn't. I think Lake St. Louis flowing into the St. Lawrence would have been confusing. So I wouldn't have minded if when Britain took over, we'd have changed the name to like Lake Elizabeth to go with Lake Victoria or something like that. Or we were joking around before the show that if it was named by modern Britain, we would have called it Lakey McLakeface, which I think is a fantastic way of solving this dispute and bringing peace between America and Canada. We'll call it Lakey McLakeface.
Right. I was joking with someone earlier that like maybe I'm slightly OCD or something, but it always bothers me a little bit that like all of the five Great Lakes, four of them have names from Native American languages, and then there's Lake Superior, which because it's the biggest lake, they call it Superior. We either need to change the other four to have English names, or just call Lake Superior Lake Gimigachi, so that they all have Native names. Now I guess in the eyes of the State Department, you've got two lakes with English names, Superior and America, and then four lakes with Native names, Erie, Huron, and Michigan.
So, I mean, there's a certain amount of, okay, Donald Trump is kind of good at just being funny, but this is making a lot of, like, this is making the trade conflict more personal. It seems like it's making it harder to solve, a bit more vicious. Like, is that what's going on here? This is something that it's now about more than trade. It's about culture. And you're starting to establish much more bad blood between these two.
I think so. That's my take on this. I wrote an editorial for The Trumpet back in the Greenland debate about a principle of leadership that Theodore Roosevelt was really good at, titled Speak Softly and Carry a Big Stick. So in diplomatic relations like this, you do want to be diplomatic. You don't want to make your job harder by being unnecessarily insulting. But like you don't want to be a pushover either. Consequences that like lines that you don't want to cross. So in a dispute like this, if President Trump has decided that there's lines he doesn't want to cross on automotive tariffs. I'm not necessarily saying here that those are bad lines. It's a complicated topic. There's a lot of viewpoints on it. But what I will say is that basically at a time when you had trade negotiations that were going well, and then they fell apart over some personal disagreements between the trade envoys and the exact tariff you wanted to put on certain automotive things, just changing a lake's name for really no other reason than just to upset people has not made it more likely that we're going to come up with a trade agreement that's going to be in the best interest of everybody, or even in the best interest of America. If you're looking at this from an American First standpoint, it's like I feel like the Carney administration is less likely to concede to Trump's tariff demands now than they were before he renamed the lake. So I feel like there is an important like leadership standpoint there of just being, speak softly and carry a big stick. It's like don't be a pushover in trade negotiations. There's plenty of countries that do take advantage of the United States. I'm not necessarily saying that Canada's first and foremost on those lists. We have bigger trade enemies, which brings us to another important prophetic point of why I think this particular trade war is something America should be less focused on, is we have much bigger trade disputes with China and with the European Union than we do with Canada. And even the trade disputes we have with Canada, because the Canadian economy is so small, it's roughly equivalent to New York State. So it's like, even if we are giving Canada like very favorable trade terms, its economy is so small compared to ours that it doesn't hurt us much. And so even if we do lose a little bit of money or hurt our own auto manufacturing industry a little bit, the geopolitical benefits of keeping Canada in America's sphere of orbit probably vastly outweigh whatever minor damage it might do to the U.S. automotive sector. Because what we're seeing now is Canada realizing that, like, okay, well, our previously close trade relationship to the United States, which, by the way, is so close that some people even liken it to, like, two organisms that share a heart. And that, like, when you just look at the geography, the road system's interconnected, the pipeline systems are interconnected. Even though there's two different governments, our trade system's so integrated that it's like if North America was an animal, it would be like one organism. And so driving the personal wedge with Canada is prompting Canada to reach out to the European Union, try to establish more favorable trade relationships there. And I feel like a Canada that's in a close economic relationship with the European Union is a bigger threat to the United States than a Canada that maybe has some very favorable automotive part manufacturing things that hurts American automotive manufacturers maybe a little bit, but when you do the calculus of it, the hurt is definitely much, much less than the geopolitical ramifications of having Canada divorced from the United States and pulling into a close economic relationship with the European Union, which is our much bigger trade rival on the world scene.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I feel like nobody comes out particularly well out of this story. Like you say, you've got Donald Trump kind of unnecessarily antagonizing Canada. And there's the point that Mr. Stephen Fleury will make on the Trumpet Daily, that he's got lots of nice things to say about Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin and some of these mass murderers, and yet can't find anything nice to say about Canada, where, you know, whatever Canada may have done to harm the United States, it's nothing on the scale of Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un or some of the mullahs in Iran, which America's actively at war with, and sometimes he's had quite nice things to say about them. On the other hand, you've got Canada going and now empowering the rising Holy Roman Empire, empowering Germany, working to draw closer to Europe. It's kind of baffling hit from Britain to watch. Like, we've just escaped. We've just gotten out of the European Union. And you've kind of like got Canada under Mark Carney, who worked quite hard to stop us from getting out of the European Union, rushing to try and go back into that union, or not back in, but rushing to join that union and to really subordinate themselves to Europe. It's not really a great response from either. And it's going to be a curse to both sides. And this is, I think you were talking about this last week, Andrew, this, or maybe Mihailo was, I think in context, no, it was last week, it was in context of Israel and the Jews, and talking about the division that the Jews in the Middle East, Britain and America, these are brother nations. And Mr. Armstrong proves this in the United States and Britain in prophecy, that God had these promises of national greatness applying to several nations, to Abraham, and these promises of superpower status to multiple nations. Well, that can't just apply to Israel in the Middle East. There is more to it than that if we're going to believe our Bibles. So Britain and America are also descended from Israel in the Middle East, and these two powers, or these powers, they're brother nations. And the division between them is a curse. And anciently, it was, I think Judah was the one that initially got Assyria involved. You had a conflict between Israel and Judah was the one that went to the king of Assyria and said, hey, can you help us? And the king of Assyria, you know, over the course of the next few years, ended up completely invading the northern tribes of Israel and then turning on Judah and attacking them as well. And it was division that opened the door for that to happen. In modern prophecy, it talks again about Judah turning to Germany because they don't rely on the United States. So you've got division there being a major curse. But I think there's also division between Ephraim and Manasseh, between Britain and the British Commonwealth and America. And you see that coming between Canada and the United States. And that is a curse. And then it's in the book of Isaiah. You turn into two or three chapters later. I think it's in Isaiah 11 from memory that talks about the divide. But you go a couple of chapters just in the future, and it talks about the unity between them being a blessing of what will come later. And so it's not just unity on any terms. It's about rallying around God's law and around God's government. But when these nations do that and they come together, they're a blessing to each other. They're a blessing to the whole world. So this division that we're seeing growing up between them, it is a major curse. And that's I think the big picture behind a lot of what is happening. But there have been a lot of other stories in the U.S., a lot of social stories in particular. What else do you have for us, Andrew?
Yes, that's absolutely right. A lot of other stories in the Anglo-American world. I have got three other ones I'll bring to your attention quickly before we move to the next segment. One of them's actually still on trade war, particularly and unusually, a case where Donald Trump is fighting the rest of the Republican Party to get rid of some tariffs. This is a particular case where if you've been to a grocery store in the United States recently, you've seen that the price of a pound of lean ground beef for the first time in U.S. history is now greater than the federal minimum wage. So someone making minimum wage would have to work more than an hour in order to afford a pound of beef. The reason for that is the Western United States is in its worst mega drought in 1,200 years. The Mayan Empire was still a thing the last time it was this dry. And that has profound implications for how many cattle you can raise on it. The cattle herd has actually dwindled down to 86 million cows, which sounds like a lot, but it's roughly 1 cow for 4 people. Where if you go back, even as recently in the 70s, America used to have 1 cow for 2 people. So beef is twice as scarce as it once was. And supply and demand, if the supply is more scarce, the price goes up. President Trump's trying to do away with tariffs on beef so we can import more from Brazil and from Argentina and from Australia and other places to bring the price of beef down. which would make grocery shoppers happy. But it's also got a lot of Republican ranchers upset at him because they're already struggling to make a living in these dry conditions. And now, not only can they not raise many cows on this parched land, but they've got to compete with foreign beef as well. And so this is a prophecy that really puts the importance of the previous story on trade relations importance, is because historically America's been able to argue that we don't need free trade with the rest of the world because we're food self-sufficient. And that's historically been true. However, there are Bible prophecies in Leviticus and 26 and Deuteronomy 28, these same prophecies that said if America turns away from God, he will send a foreign nation to economically besiege them, also say he will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass, or like devastating droughts. So maybe if God just cursed with the drought, you could buy food from other nations. Or maybe if God just cursed with the trade war, you could grow your own food. But if both curses hit you at the same time, you get in a position where you can't actually grow your own food and other nations won't trade with you. And that's a prophecy we highlight on this show a lot from places like Ezekiel 4 about just like a long 390-day trade siege that gets so bad that you actually have famine conditions in the United States because this farmland where you've traditionally been food self-sufficient isn't producing food like it used to due to extended natural disasters. America's also got a growing problem with Islamic terrorism and radicalism. This is a story that actually happened last week, and I didn't get to, about a woman named Jessica Bowie. She renamed herself Aisha Saif, praised God on the September 11th attack, and this summer planted a bomb in a DoorDash bag in order to try to commit an act of terrorism. So she was arrested last week, kind of bringing public attention to this fact that there is a growing Islamic terrorism problem in the United States, something I'll probably talk more about on the show next week or the week after, because one of the primary Senate candidates for Michigan, a Democrat who's running to be Michigan Senator, Abdul al-Sayed, he's going to be celebrating Pakistani Independence Day next week at a conference in Michigan that's going to include many radical American Muslims, like the type of people who aren't just celebrating Pakistan's independence from the British Empire, but are actually praising the Pakistani prime minister who harbored Osama bin Laden for so many years, and people who work for organizations that are pretty closely connected with the groups that helped organize the World Trade Center bombings on September 11th, 2001. So this is not just a radical Muslim who's like a fringe figure, but someone who's prominent in the Democratic Party and has a realistic shot at becoming a senator this fall. So a shocking story that we'll talk more about after the meeting happens, most likely. But something we'll give you a little bit of a preview this week. And then, since we've been talking about some pretty sobering stories, we'll lighten it up with something that could be a slight bit of good news. In addition, Donald Trump's executive order about Lake America is not his only executive order these past couple weeks. He's also looking at an executive order that would make it so U.S. states couldn't send mail-in ballots to people who can't prove they're citizens. Like, they have to be on a citizenship list in order to send mail-in ballots to them. And this is an idea to, like, cut down on election fraud in the United States. Something that a lower court ruled unconstitutional or illegal. And then the Supreme Court came in and didn't give a definitive ruling on how we're going to do mail-in ballots from here on out, but definitely said that since the lower court didn't prove how states had been harmed by an executive order saying only citizens can vote, like in order to sue someone, you have to prove that you've been harmed. And since that is the law, the only citizens can vote, an executive order just reaffirming that doesn't really hurt anybody. The Supreme Court said that the Trump executive order can go ahead. There might be some other legal challenges to it in the lead up to the coming up election. But just a sign that the Supreme Court is actually working to back Donald Trump on some of the good things he's doing, like trying to cut down on election fraud in U.S. elections by making sure that you have to be an American to cast a vote in an American election. And if you're not on an American citizenship list already, you can't just send you a mail-in ballot and hope for the best.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Well, going from a new conflict breaking out between America and Canada, in the Middle East, we've got potentially an older conflict ending. To get the latest on this, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, on Tuesday, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are the main Kurdish militia in Syria, announced its formal dissolution. With their leader in Damascus, side by side with the president of Syria, Ahmed al-Shara, saying that they are now fully integrated into the main Syrian military. They are essentially giving up whatever autonomy they claim to for all these years, whatever autonomy they've been able to hold on to since the Syrian government had an offensive against them earlier this year. This is, in one sense, better for them than anything Syria's previous leadership under Bashar al-Assad would have offered them. Shara has tried to give a few olive branches to the Kurds throughout the months. He's made Kurdish an official protected language. He's protected Kurdish holidays. And the former leader will now serve as one of his presidential advisors. But for all intents and purposes, this militia that throughout the chaotic years of the civil war, when you had Assad's people, when you had Shara's people, when you had ISIS constantly gaining and losing territory and committing some massive atrocities, the SDF and its affiliated militias, they've been able to hold their own throughout basically northeast Syria with American support, and probably been the most stable and least radical government in the whole area. And their formal dissolution certainly marks a watershed moment for developments in Syria.
So in the Middle East, we're used to ancient rivalries, reigniting conflicts that have smoldered for years, or just wars going on without apparent solution. And how long-term is this peace, and what are the long-term ramifications of it?
Well, this is not a ceasefire or a 10-year period to figure things out. This is officially the Kurdish opposition to Syria's central government. Regardless who's in charge, that's all over. It is, if anybody remembers from, I believe it was January, when the Syrian government basically had a lightning offensive against the Kurds, their positions collapsed a lot quicker than anybody expected. They lost a lot of territory within a matter of days. Everybody basically saw the writing was on the wall for them. They didn't surrender completely. They still had their functioning government. They still controlled some territory. But they knew that if they didn't sign, it's the logic President Trump tries to apply to everywhere else in the world. If they didn't sign some kind of deal, a bad deal is better than no deal. And this has been having the encouragement of the United States for two reasons. One, I think the U.S. was very surprised how quickly the Kurdish forces collapsed. When America has been supplying them so many weapons throughout the years, when America even has bases of its own in Kurdish territory, and yet they still weren't able to put up much of a defense. But also, this is part of President Trump's general recalibrating Middle Eastern alliances, reviewing where America has soldiers, sending people back home, or in this case, trying to consolidate Middle Eastern forces around the war with Iran. A lot of people have been wondering why America is in Syria in the first place, and even when President Trump was in his first term, completely withdrawing from Syria, from Kurdish areas, was something he was trying to implement. So, in a sense, this not only is a longstanding goal of the Trump administration, but it is reflective of general trends that he's trying to apply in the region. And also, of course, President Trump has gotten along really well with Ahmed al-Sharaa and has been trying to do everything he can to normalize Syria's place in the international world, to bring him into the U.S. sphere of influence. Another story this week about Syria is that the State Department formally removed Syria from the list of state sponsors of terrorism, a legal designation that basically freezes any kind of activity the Syrian government wants to do anywhere in the world with anybody, not even just the U.S., if those countries wanted to still do business with the U.S., that is. This is a bit of a formality at this point. They've already removed personal sanctions on Sharaa and on his movement, etc., etc. They've already helped Syria out a lot in ways that you normally wouldn't expect the U.S. to support a country on that list. But now it's official, and it's another growing sign on how close President Trump is getting to the new government, which the government itself is made up of a former terrorist militia. It was Al-Qaeda's franchise in Syria. Technically, the designation was put under the Assad regime and everything they were doing, and that's all history. But just because Assad's gone, just because all the programs he was doing is gone, that doesn't mean in this case, the new guys have even more overt links with terrorism. And at the very, very least, removing this designation, I would say, would be extremely premature.
So Syria is being rehabilitated, welcomed back into the community of nations. Patching things up between the Kurds is just one more step towards making them, say, a normal state where you don't have some ethnic group with their own private militia operating within that state. What are the ramifications of that then, of Syria no longer being this kind of divided basket case, but something nations can do business with?
Well, this is definitely going to shore up Sharaa's overall consolidation of the country. The Kurds were his last major opposition to his rule. That's now all gone. And now Syria will be able to contact a lot of countries that would have been afraid to do so beforehand. One particular one we're watching for is Europe, based off of a prophecy in Psalm 83, which I feel like is the go-to prophecy I've been talking about every single episode for the past month. But in a nutshell, it speaks of an end-time nation or alliance of nations forming under German patronage, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. That's what verse 4 reads. And among those nations are the Hagarenes, or the ancient name of Syria today. If anybody wanted to learn more about the details of this prophecy and why it's a prophecy, our other programs cover it. Mr. Fleury's book, The King of the South, covers that in more detail. But what this particular move means for Syria, as you mentioned, Syria has been a patchwork of different competing groups and militias. Sharaa, before he took over the government, you look at what he was doing in his area, and he was running it as an Islamist state, not that different from what the Taliban is doing in Afghanistan, less severe, but the same kind of persecution of minorities, discrimination against women. And that was what he was fighting for this whole time in Syria, and if he wanted to push ahead with that, he has a freer hand to do so right now. We talked recently about him even getting an avenue for nuclear weapons if he wanted to. If America was going to prop up anybody in the Middle East, at the very least, Sharaa's Syria would probably on paper be at the bottom of the list. And yet we're seeing America prop it up, even though they stand for basically that the name of Israel, that the name of America, the America is included in that, maybe no more in remembrance, and empowering this government and allowing it to make new partnerships like we expect from Psalm 83 is going to hurt America much more drastically than anybody's probably expecting right now.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. What else do you have for us from the Middle East?
A little bit of an update from the war in Iran. Iran and Oman have reportedly come to an agreement on revenue sharing from the Strait of Hormuz and route mapping that gives Iran some kind of control over both the entry and exit points. The actual details are murky at this point, but it looks like Iran is getting away with its plans to toll the Strait of Hormuz, which has been an American objective not to let them do that. But it looks like they're steaming ahead with that anyway, and America's not putting up that much of a resistance to that. And then finally, technically this happened a couple of weeks ago, but there was a report in the United Nations talking about how Gaza has become one of the most overfed areas in the Middle East as of this past year, etc., flying in the face of all those stories of Israel trying to starve the Gazan people into genocide. Our executive editor, Stephen Fleury, he had an article this week about how the lack of news about this is news in and of itself when you have one of the actual organizations pushing this narrative for the longest time come in and basically repudiate its claims, and all the soundboards in the media are not taking with this. They were perfectly fine with demonizing Israel when they knew the evidence was shaky to begin with, and then when that own evidence is contradicted, they just stay tight-lipped.
Well, I think you covered all the facts. I didn't really, I guess I could probably spend the next few minutes just being generally outraged at it, but it is just so revealing. Like, Gaza doesn't have a famine problem. Gaza literally has an obesity problem. And the same media that's been putting this on their front page for years, Israel is deliberately starving people in Gaza. There's no, sorry, we got it wrong at all, let alone equal in prominence to the lies that they were spreading. So I think a little story, but a very revealing story. And I think very revealing that we didn't cover it earlier. It was reported earlier. It was given so little coverage that even we didn't notice it. It was just an attempt to completely bury the story. We made sure we slotted it in at the end here. Well, that is the end of the show. Thank you to all of our panelists. Thank you to Mr. Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us, letters@thetrumpet.com. You can go to our website, thetrumpet.com, or look down in the show notes for more information on anything that we have talked about. Apologies for no Wednesday show this week. Our video editor was sick. I think he's almost recovered, though. So instead, we will air our Trumpet magazine in review next week. You can look forward to that on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.